welcome to episode 8 of All Crime No Cattle, a Texas true crime podcast. I'm Erin.
And I'm Shay.
And today we have a very special episode for you, one that I am very excited about. It has to do with
satanic murder on the Texas border.
And so personally, I'm excited about this because A, I don't know anything about this case. And B, a lot of the cases that we deal with in true crime have to do with the Satanic Panic, which happened in the 80s and into the 90s, where throughout the United States, there was this panic having to do with people, usually like white suburban moms, being scared of the threat of the satanic cult and basically blaming everything bad that happened in society on satanic cults. Yeah. So, and we see this a lot in Columbine and the Memphis Three and other cases where we had a lot of people blaming things like metal music and movies and video
Dungeons
games
and Dragons.
Yeah, on Satan. And so a lot of it was complete BS, and we know that now. But what's interesting about this case, and the reason why I'm really excited about it, is this is an actual satanic cult that actually hurt and killed a lot of people from what you've told me. And so yep. I'm very excited to hear more about it.
Oh yeah. And this is going to be our slight disclaimer right here. So, you know, if you kind of shy away from things involving the occult, mutilation, this case has it all. And there's definitely going to be, you know, drug cartels and multiple murders and other nefarious activities. So if that's something that you're not down with, then you might want to just kind of click away at this point.
For me, I'm all in.
Yeah,
me too. I am ready for it.
And that's something about this case. Like every time I look something up about it, it just seemed too crazy, over the top, ridiculous. And at one point, I told you about this case, and we were both just like, "Is this even a real thing? Did this actually happen?" And that's the interesting part about it is the further and further I got into it, yes, in fact, this all did happen, and that's what makes it even more terrifying and ridiculous and over the top. So if you're ready to get into it, I am.
Absolutely. Let's go.
Sources from this case, I did our usual rummage through Wikipedia and Murderpedia, obviously. But, you know, we like to do a deep dive, and so we're going back to the old well of Texas Monthly. We're going to look at the article called The Work of the Devil from 1989, the year that this case happened, from Gary Cartwright. And I highly recommend Gary Cartwright's work. He's one of their alumni from Texas Monthly who's gotten a lot of journalistic accolades. He's done some really great work. Unfortunately, he did pass away in 2017.
Well, he lives on, not only in his own writing, but through this podcast.
That's right. So let's build up a little bit of setting for this case. Let's get ourselves a nice little baseline of where we are in Texas, where this is going on. So this case takes place in some interesting parts of the Texas South, one of which is Brownsville, Texas. It's at the southernmost tip of Texas, kind of like that little hanging point of the Texas shape. That's where we're going to be at, like right next to Mexico. It's on the northern bank of the Rio Grande, directly north and across the border from Matamoros, Tamaulipas, Mexico. The Brownsville metropolitan area had about 500,000 people in 2014. And of course, we're in 1989, so it's going to be a little different, but we don't have the census data from that. But in 2014, they had about 500,000 people in the area of Brownsville. Now, when you include the area of Matamoros in, it puts in about another 500,000 people. So that's about 1 million people smashed into this area of Texas that's very off the beaten path, like very close to another country. And it's the ninth biggest metropolitan area in Texas, actually, which I did not know. It's one of the fastest growing cities in the nation.
Interesting.
And part of this is because Brownsville is a major port town, and it received a major boom in the early 1900s when it developed its steel industry. So nowadays, it's still one of the fastest growing areas, like I said, in the nation, and it's become one of the premier international trade hubs with Mexico. So the easiest way to get something from Mexico across the border to the United States is obviously through this very close connection and this ocean port that we have right in Brownsville. So one of the main seasonal attractions near Brownsville is South Padre Island, and it is a barrier island made out of Texas coastline. Formerly, it was a national park, and it was open to settlement in the 70s. And in 1988, the island had around 1,000 residents and about 100 businesses. So, Aaron, if you'll look at your pictures that I sent you in our notes, you'll get an aerial image from satellite of South Padre Island, and you kind of get an idea of how smashed in this little sliver of a barrier island is for this little seasonal resort town.
Yeah, it looks like a tiny, tiny little thin peninsula kind of jutting out there. I've noticed that the La Quinta Inn and Suites is highlighted. So it doesn't look like there's a whole lot around.
There's not. It's pretty barren, actually. Like, there's not a lot. There's hardly any trees. Yeah. There's just...
Well, you know, I think most people in Texas, at least, have heard of South Padre Island as being a party town, which exactly. I'm sure we're about to get into, yes, right? Yes,
exactly. Being that this island is predominantly just made up of coastline that was pretty much bifurcated when they came in and made Port Isabel, the big import port to Brownsville, they kind of didn't have anything to do with this island besides it being a natural port until they opened it up to settlement. So now it's become this big, huge resort town. Their economy is almost completely based on tourism. Every year, tens of thousands of high school and college students from all over the country flock to this remote island. And this is for the infamous Texas Spring Break Party. On your pictures, you'll have another picture of what it kind of looks like. I don't know if you've ever been to South Padre Island for spring break.
That looks disgusting. I would feel so angry. You know how I am, like, when the mall gets packed a little bit too much for me?
Oh, yeah.
And I just get, like, the rage of just being amongst a ton of people, and I just get really mad. I would be so uncomfortable here. It looks awful.
Yeah, we
get... We'll post this picture for sure if you want to look at the beach of South Padre Island.
Because it's basically... It's just a sea of people.
Crammed... Full of people.
And that's what it's like. But yeah, so you kind of get the idea of what we're talking about. And this is the exact sort of entertainment that drew our victim, in this case, Mark Kilroy, and his three friends to South Padre Island, March of 1989. So let's talk a little bit more about Mark James Kilroy. Let's give you a little bit of background about Mark. He's born March 5th in 1968 in Chicago, Illinois. He's the son of James William and Helen Josephine. A little after Mark was born, the family decided to move from the chilly Midwest, as Midwesterners do, to the warm state of Texas. They settled down in the little town of Santa Fe, Texas, which is kind of a small suburb outside of Houston. So another Houston case. Gosh, it feels like we're covering a lot of Houston cases.
In Houston, why do you keep murdering people or having your people murdered?
Yeah,
you need to focus on that, Houston.
You know, from the 70s to pretty much the present, they have been in the top three murder That's capital true. Cities in
that
the nation.
That is absolutely true.
So that's probably why they keep popping up. So him and his brother Keith grow up in Santa Fe. Their family dynamic was very wholesome and a Catholic type. They're religious. They're involved in the community. And even from early on, Mark was clearly special and destined for great things. He excelled at academics. He was very good at sports. He was a member of the Boy Scouts. He was an honor student in high school, a member of the student council. He was ranked 14th in his graduating class. And then after graduating from Santa Fe High School in 1986, he enrolls at Texas State University in San Marcos, Texas. Soon after, he would transfer to Tarleton State University in Stephenville, Texas for a basketball scholarship. After a while at Tarleton, Mark decided he wanted to give up his athletic pursuits, and he had bigger ideas on the horizon for his future. He set his sights on becoming a medical student. He made his last transfer to the University of Texas at Austin as a pre-med student and began work on preparing for the MCAT exams. So you can see that he's well-liked, he's got a lot of friends, he's an accomplished student.
Yeah, so I mean, he seems like a very well-rounded teenager, somebody who, if you were their parent, you'd be really proud of this guy.
Exactly. So let's jump forward to spring break, South Padre Island, 1989. The hair's teased, the jeans are acid washed.
Everybody's covered in a film of Aquanet.
That's right. So Mark Kilroy and a close friend, Bradley Moore, have begun talking about spring break since the start of the fall semester previously. They've been talking it up because Bradley, although he's a sophomore in electrical engineering at Texas A&M, Mark, this is his senior year. And so, like, after this year, they might not get a chance to hang out all his buddies and college students.
Yeah, especially if Mark's going off to medical school.
Exactly. He's going to be really busy.
Yeah.
So their plan was, as soon as they finished their midterm exams, they were going to all meet up with their two other pals, Bill Huddleston and Brent Martin, and they're going to head down to South Padre Island for perhaps the spring break of their lives. So Bill, Brent, Bradley, and Mark, they all met each other playing various sports back in high school at Santa Fe, Texas. All four are young men. They're tall. They're athletic. They're clean cut. They didn't do drugs, and they were all considered to be very serious students.
All right, so they're all just like wanting to take a break, kind of let their hair down, go crazy maybe a little in South Padre Island.
Yeah.
In 1989. Okay.
That's pretty much it.
It sounds pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I can't fault them for that.
Exactly. So shortly after midnight on Friday, March 10th, the four boys start for South Padre Island in Brent's Cutlass. And after they take their time, they make a couple of stops. And by mid-morning on Friday, as the group arrives at the Sheridan Hotel on South Padre Island, they're feeling like their spring break has just begun. They're a little bit early. They're before the main wave of partygoers, which typically doesn't get there till Monday. There are clear signs that preparations have already been made for the arrival of this party herd. They make notice that all the furniture in the Sheridan has been removed in the lobby for safekeeping, because they're kind of preparing for the...
Oh, that's a bad sign.
Yeah, it's going to be raucous.
When you have to physically remove all items from your business because you're so afraid the drunken partygoers are going to destroy them, that's bad.
Well, and here's the other thing. They didn't have enough space to store it, so they had to store it off-site back on the mainland in Port Isabel, because there's not even a place on South Padre Island to put the furniture.
It's so tiny.
Yeah. Because it's just a little sliver of used-to-be coral reef.
So everybody in the entire island just ships their furniture or whatever they don't want broken away?
Oh, yeah. And, like, this season is known to be, like, the time where people who actually live there who aren't involved in the tourist industry just leave.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I think I'd be one of those people. Can't do it. I feel annoyed from that picture, just looking at it. I mean, I couldn't be there.
So eager to begin their adventure, the four young men, they shower up, they hit the beach, they start experiencing all the pregame festivities that are getting set up. Beer companies are sponsoring all sorts of things, like free movies, concerts. They have areas where you can call home for free, because that was a thing back in the day. You had to call collect. If you didn't have money, they've got free phones that have been paid for, so you can call home and check in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they've got surf simulator rides. There's religious organizations from all over the country, one of which was from Madison, Wisconsin, and they were handing out pamphlets and free suntan lotion, trying to spread the message, pray instead of party.
I wonder how well they did on South Padre Island. Yeah.
A beer company had also offered for free use of a swimming pool for students who didn't mind being part of a filmed commercial that was taking place there. And all four of them actually took advantage of this and got in the pool for the beer commercial. By Sunday, the group had developed a pattern. They'd hit the beach in the morning, they'd get some lunch, maybe go check out the Miss Tan Line contest that was happening at the Sheraton. God. Yeah. And then they would try to maybe get a nap in the afternoon, and then they'd start planning the serious business, which was their nighttime festivities. So Sunday night, they wanted to try their first shot at partying across the border in Matamoros, Mexico. So they end up hitting a Sonic drive-thru on their way to the border, and they meet up with a group of young ladies who are also heading off to party in Matamoros. And so they all line up their cars, and they head down the 24-mile highway that ends at the southern tip of Texas. And they both park their cars in the parking lot at the Brownsville side of the International Bridge, and they walk on over to Matamoros.
Wow, and that's it. They just walk to Mexico. Mm-hmm.
So if you look up this particular border crossing on Google Maps, you can not only see where they park, but you can also see like the obvious dichotomy of the Rio Grande River between Brownsville and Matamoros, Mexico. The color change is stark. So in Matamoros, you see the whitewashed brick buildings and kind of the squalor and the slums and how tightly it's compacted. Across the river in Brownsville, people have these big, luscious green yards, big houses in suburban neighborhoods. It goes from upper class to extreme poverty within like 100 to 200 feet.
Yeah, basically as you cross the border.
Yes.
Okay.
So keep that in mind.
So this is during the time where you could basically just travel between U.S. and Mexico without having a passport, without really having to go through the checks that you do now. This is something we also talked about with Regina and Ricky Lee in part two of The Truck Stop Killer, where they thought that they had both fled to into Mexico, and so they were afraid that... Well, they went into Mexico, and that's all we can do about it, because there was basically no real borderline like there is now, where it's difficult to cross the border. You need a passport. You need to have all your stuff checked. They're going to do, I guess, background checks. I'm not really sure what all they do.
Well, they're going to run your information and see who you are, yeah, document exactly. your crossing and everything.
Yeah, but back then, I mean, you could literally just cross the border, and it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, this particular border situation that we're talking about, it's a known loophole to the spring break partygoer scene of the 80s and 90s.
Okay, so let me guess.
Sure.
I'm assuming that Mexico has a lower drinking age than the United States does, and so that's why a lot of these kids are crossing the border, because they want to get to Mexico where they can drink underage.
That is correct. You're like a young adolescent.
Sherlock Holmes?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know where they're going over there. It's because 16-year-old high school students could cross and drink beer and wine legally in Mexico.
Oh, at 16?
Yeah, at 16.
That was the drinking age?
Uh-huh. And wow. As long as you were 18, you could have hard liquor.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's why the high school students were really into this, but... What happens is like there's all this nighttime entertainment and like this big party atmosphere that's drawing the college students as well, because they know it's a madhouse. It's crazy. It's loud music and bands and all this stuff. You know, like we said, this caused a large migration of South Padre Islanders to cross for a less controlled, crazy, taboo sort of experience. Obviously, the town of Matamoros was wise to this situation. In fact, many local bars were known to change their names during this time of season to cater to the gringos. And case in point, the first night, Mark's group spent the whole evening at a place called Sergeant Pepper's, which is an album from the Beatles.
What was their everyday name?
Oh, man. It was like Coco Locos or something like that. I can't remember offhand. I didn't write it down.
Okay.
Yeah. I've also seen a few other funny bar name switches listed as well, like the London Pub or even the Hard Rock Cafe, which is obviously not a part of the official international chain whatsoever. So Mark and his buddies have a good time partying at Matamoros, and then they said their goodbyes to their young lady companions that they had met, and they head back to the hotel in South Padre Island. That night, they make plans to return the following night to party with the huge wave of spring breakers that are coming in on Monday, the official start of the long party week. So at this point, I think we need to just pull back this thin veil of partying and tourism in Matamoros, and we need to discuss something quite a bit more nefarious, dangerous. So stay with me here. There's going to be a bit of history and set up, and it's all on this side of the border, but I think it's going to be well worth it. Matamoros City is in the northeastern Mexican state of Tamaulipas, and not only was it a fast-growing city, but it had a thriving international trade industry, like we talked about. It has this big, giant manufacturing hub and industrial district, and it's also really rife with crime. We're talking about 1989. We're big into, like, the drug crime war that's going on with cocaine between Cuba and Florida. This really becomes a shifting of drug operations to the Mexican-Texas border here at Matamoros, and we're going to see that. Drug dealers, cartel lords, and hitmen, they run the streets. They're the general criminal thugs on the day-to-day in Matamoros. The city was used to regular shootouts and steady amounts of bloody violence on their day-to-day. This time of year, however, it was like an unspoken peace or like a respite from this flow of daily blood that Matamoros was used to. After all, there were deals to be made, drugs to be sold, and no one from the street vendors to the drug dealers wanted to stop this movement of American dollars across the border. This year was different, however. One of the most powerful drug smuggling families in Matamoros, they changed the script. The Hernandez family had a long history of controlling the flow of drugs and illegal smuggling along this region of the border for several generations. Their reach had a density of family relatives on both sides of the border that included brothers, nephews, cousins, and in-laws. Beginning in a small ejido, which is a communal farming village, the Hernandez family decided to use the property as a marijuana farm and processing center.
Hmm.
And this is
one way to do it.
Yeah. And it's a region that's like right outside of Matamoros. So for almost 30 years, the Hernandez organization had profited handsomely. Their children and grandchildren went to school in Brownsville, Texas. Some even went to college and graduated. This is all led by Saul Hernandez Rivera. He's the patriarch of the family business. Saul Hernandez is like a vicious cartel boss. And in January of 1986, both the publisher and the star reporter of El Popular, which is the paper in Matamoros, they're gunned down in front of the paper's office. And it's suspected that the culprit is, you guessed it, Saul Hernandez, because they've started talking about family business. They're starting to link the Hernandez family to these large cartel backers from Mexico City. Saul's days were numbered, however, because 6 months later, Saul is actually gunned down via machine gun at a restaurant by rival drug dealers. And 2 years after this, this ensuing power struggle in the Hernandez family, it really causes their drug business to struggle badly. And I mentioned the date before was 1986, so this is like 3 years before our case.
Mm-hmm.
So the family's divided here without Saul. Not only in power, but between relatives that they have on both sides of the border between Texas and Mexico. One of the three remaining brothers, the youngest of the four, is Elio Hernandez. He stepped up to take control of the organization. He was the leader of the Mexican side of the cartel, and he resembled his brother Saul the most. He was ruthless, clever, ambitious, but he had a taste for the supernatural.
Ooh.
Yeah. After one of the other brothers was arrested on the U.S. side in a botched drug smuggling operation outside of Brownsville, Elio's opportunity to seize control presents itself. Elio's girlfriend, Sarah Aldrete, was rumored to be a practitioner of black magic. Now, let's get into black magic just for a second, culturally. So we're talking about, this is something that involves the spiritual, which is something to be feared and harnessed by the people of this region. Quote, witches and curanderos were as much a part of their daily lives as lawyers and doctors were to, say, the Kilroy family. I'm a scientist. I have a PhD in anthropology from the University of Texas. But when I go over there to work, I put a cross around my neck, says professor of anthropology Antonio Zavaleta. Zavaleta I bring up because not only is he an expert on curanderismo, which is a person who practices herbal medicine and magic, but he's also Sarah Aldrete's Texas Southmost College professor in Brownsville. And he saw her on a daily basis.
So Sarah Aldrete was this professor's student?
Yes. So she's...
Oh, wow.
She's... I'm going to get into this. She's kind of like leading a double life. So definitely, this is a professor of Sarah Aldrete. Once Elio gets control of the family operation, he employs Sarah to begin implementing practices of Santeria. Now, Santeria is an Afro-Caribbean religion that relies on animal sacrifice to achieve power and to punish one's enemies. Sarah, authorities and friends will find this out later, she's leading a double life. On the one hand, she's a straight-A, unassuming student at Texas Southmost College in Brownsville. On the other hand, she's practicing black magic for the Hernandez family at night. If this is starting to sound far-fetched, I understand. Like I said, this is where I started kind of pulling back from the story and being like, is this real? But let me assure you, again, it's all real. So the reason I bring all this up is to introduce our most prominent, terrifying, and notorious key player south of the border, none other than well-known serial killer Adolfo de Jesus Constanzo. One of the theories goes that in 1987, Sarah Aldrete, she's got connections to Mexico City's occult community, and she puts Elio Hernandez, the newly appointed cartel boss, in contact with Adolfo. Elio, looking to improve his business and hearing of the particular benefits that Adolfo can offer, agrees to meet with him. And so I've got a picture for you over there of Adolfo that you can check out.
Ugh. He looks like a cross between Emilio Estevez and Corey Feldman, but crossed with a little bit of maybe Prince.
I was going to say Freddie Mercury, but I think...
Or Freddie Mercury. I think you're on board with that.
He's got like the chiseled jaw, but he's also got the bad Corey Feldman hair in the first one.
And absolutely.
He's wearing like open-breasted shirts. He was
and
also...
what looks like a fur jacket.
Oh, yeah. And he loved leather. He would wear these like ornate occult necklaces. Yeah, he frequented gay bars in Mexico City's Zona Rosa gay district. He was just super over the top, flashy. He had this mystique about him. The other thing about Adolfo is he's the leader of a group of drug smuggling cultists in Mexico known as Los Narcosatánicos. His followers called him El Padrino, the high priest. It's also interesting here because he kind of has like this relationship with his followers, but he also has a different relationship with some of the cartel bosses and drug leaders. They just call him the Cuban. And that's coming from the fact that he was a Cuban American.
Okay, so he was a Cuban American that lived in Mexico?
Yeah, and it's emphasizing the fact that he's an outsider from a different culture, and he's also like a consultant to these cartel members and drug smuggling operations. Born in Miami, Florida, Adolfo had grown up in a predominantly Cuban neighborhood. His mother, who was reported to be a witch, however, I've seen conflicting information on this. I don't know if she just introduced him to witchcraft and the occult, but supposedly she introduced him to an Afro-Caribbean religion called Payo Mayombe. It has its roots in the Central Congo. Now, this is a religion that focuses on sacrifice just as Santeria does, but it differs because instead of animal sacrifice, the religion uses human body parts. These are body parts that are typically stolen from graves. These body parts are then placed with ceremonial wooden sticks in a cauldron as part of sacrificial altars. And the wooden sticks in these cauldrons are typically ones that would be used as like percussion musical implements in rituals previously.
Okay, I have a question.
Sure.
So his mother was Cuban?
Yes.
So how is she getting these religious rituals that are based out of Central Africa?
So she's originally from Puerto Rico, and she immigrates to Miami, Florida. You know, Adolfo's birth father dies, and then she ends up moving back to Puerto Rico, right next door to Haiti. And Haiti has a very rich culture of voodoo and Afro-Caribbean religions that have roots in Africa.
Oh, okay. So this is something that it came from Africa, but from quite a long time ago.
Yes.
So this is something that is sort of spread across the globe and sort of changed and intermingled with other cultures and other religious beliefs.
Yeah, that's why it's called Afro-Caribbean, is because it comes from Africa, but it's spread throughout the Caribbean. Puerto Rico, Haiti, Jamaica, they all have this kind of taboo African sacrificial religion that comes from many different places in Africa.
Okay.
This one is specifically from the Central Congo. So remember the wooden sticks, because that's going to become an interesting detail later on. Now, Adolfo, let's jump to him moving to Puerto Rico. He's going to be making regular trips to Haiti at this point, and he's trying to learn more about the Payo Mayombe religion, and he starts using the things that he's learning in conjunction with his drug dealings that he's involved in. He eventually reaches the status of high priest, or El Padrino. So let's jump forward to 1984. Adolfo takes all this knowledge that he's gotten from living on Puerto Rico and traveling to Haiti, and he moves to Mexico City. So when he gets to Mexico City, he starts his livelihood out as a tarot card reader. He began gathering a number of followers who are interested in the occult. He then uses his influence to make a profitable business for the group, overseeing the casting of spells to bring good luck. Typically, these would be very expensive rituals involving the use of chickens, goats, snakes, and zebras, even lion cubs.
Wow, so they were importing lion cubs for their rituals?
They were available, apparently.
Well, lions definitely aren't endemic to South Africa. Yeah. I mean, South America. So, I mean, I'm
and that,
sure
that goes into them being expensive rituals that he's charging these customers.
So, are these customers tourists, or are these rich locals?
Oh no, they're rich locals, okay. Like underworld people. Like these are
who
side
are involved
deals.
With the occult.
Yes.
Okay.
Or at least interested in the occult.
Yes. Okay.
Interestingly enough, he began to make powerful friendships on both sides of the law, and he would do these sort of rituals for drug dealers as well as police officers. Elio Hernandez, going back to Matamoros, he decides that the family needs this sort of skill set and this powerful figure that Adolfo represents. He sets up a meeting, and he's immediately impressed by Adolfo, who Adolfo at this time is 26 years old. He's still the elder to Elio, and Elio's captivated by him. He describes Adolfo as a smooth talker. He's well educated. He's very convincing. The Cuban offered to act as the Hernandez gang's high priest, attempting to protect its members from all of their enemies and promising them riches beyond their dreams.
Ugh.
Yeah. And in return for a share of course, the drug organization's profits.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a drug boss who is interested in the occult, and he's thinking that maybe if I get this guy, he can protect me and my business, my drug empire, by doing his occultist rituals and whatever. And that's how Adolfo is able to ingratiate himself into this drug ring.
That's exactly correct.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, this is a point where Elio knows that his family's drug business is struggling. He sees other rival drug leaders moving in on his territory. He says,
I can't do anything business-wise because maybe he's not business savvy, but what I can do is maybe get the demons or the gods or the whatever, the paranormal into my drug ring, and therefore
exactly
move my business along.
He's got that taste for the supernatural,
which is always very questionable.
Right. So at this point, Elio agreed to give up a huge part of his business to Adolfo.
So Adolfo believes 100% in his own abilities, or is he just a con man? I'm sorry. I hope I'm not jumping ahead, but I mean, this is kind of always my favorite question when it comes to people like this. Do they actually believe in their abilities, quote unquote?
Yeah.
Or are they actually just a very good con man?
Oh, no. And when it comes down to extremists, Adolfo Costanzo, he is the most extreme. He believes in what he's doing. He's a psychopath, but he's also making up part of the religion that he's exposing to these Mexican drug dealers as he goes along. But he's also believing what he's making up. And he's starting to believe his own...
Almost like a David Koresh or one of these other cult leaders who they start to rewrite the book.
Exactly.
So they go on basic principles or basic traditions, but then they start, well, this doesn't work for me, so I'm going to start going this way because the gods or whoever are shining their light down on me and I can start changing the script.
That's exactly correct.
Interesting.
And we're going to see how strong his belief is later on in the story.
Yikes.
And kind of in an L. Ron Hubbard way, we're going to see how in the end he swallows his own tincture of crap that he's giving these people.
And starts manufacturing his own BS.
Yep.
Okay.
So again, Elio agrees at this point that he's going to give over part of his business. And that the three of them, him, his girlfriend Sarah Aldrete, and Adolfo Costanzo, are going to start working together out of Matamoros from the Hernandez family ranch, and they're going to start indoctrinating the family organization into the occult. And it's at this point that we're going to jump back to Mark's story. Monday night, all the partygoers are coming in. Mark and his friends, they're having a beautiful day out at the beach. More and more partygoers are showing up. They're flocking the beaches of South Padre Island. Mark strikes up a conversation with the Miss Tanline contestants.
You know, I was Miss Tanline 2005.
Were you?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, I would believe it.
It was just because I laid out in the sun too long and just got a really bad burn. I needed a lot of aloe vera that summer.
Oh goodness.
Yeah.
The sweet release of the cool aloe vera from the fridge. You can't beat it.
Miss Tanline.
I know.
Okay. Oh, barf. All right.
And like they misspelled Tanline.
What do you mean? How do you misspell the words tan and line?
Well, they combined it into one word, and it's not one word?
I wouldn't think that's one word, no.
It's not, but they made it one word for this contest. Ew. It was Miss Tanline.
Okay. I don't even have anything to say about that. That's weird.
Well, after Mark got done with his little conversation with Miss Tanline, they all went to a condo party from one of his buddies from Tarleton State University, and they partied up there for a little bit. So it's about 10:30 p.m. when the group decides they're going to head back to Matamoros, and they're going to check out the scene across the border.
Uh-oh.
And just like last time, they park their cars over on the Brownsville side of the border, and they walk across the International Bridge to go party it up on Avenida Alvaro Obregón Street. However, this time, there's 15,000 or so high school students and college partygoers clogging the streets. It's a madhouse. People are packed. They're shoulder to shoulder, front to back. Mark and his group, they decide, you know, we need to settle on the best place with the shortest line. Like, we need to get into somewhere. We need to have a good time. We need to get out of the streets. Well, they settle on a place called Los Sombreros. And this is a club that has lots of loud music and way too much neon lighting. It's actually quite a coincidence. They choose Los Sombreros because just a year earlier, the son of the establishment's owner was gunned down out front, and the suspect was a member of the Hernandez family. So after spending enough time at Los Sombreros, Mark and his friends found themselves at the newly rebranded Hard Rock Cafe that we talked about earlier. This was some of the wildest and loudest partying that was happening. They'd spend the rest of their festivities of the night here. Around 2 a.m., Mark's friends come out of the Hard Rock Cafe and find him talking to, you guessed it, the contestant from Miss Tanline competition earlier on that day. They're by her Volkswagen out on the street. And all over Matamoros, partygoers are heading back to the International Bridge. This is a big push of a wave of students. It's like a one-way street that's heading back to the International Bridge. The whole group has a hard time staying together, and they're trying to make progress towards the bridge. And they kind of get close to the end, and Bill ducks out behind a tree to relieve himself. And when he returns to Bradley and Brent, Mark is nowhere to be found. The group of guys, the three B's, Bill, Bradley, and Brent, they search around until 4:30 in the morning for Mark. The bars are closed. It's long after the crowd has moved back across the International Bridge, and there's no sign of Mark Kilroy. They go ahead and head across the bridge. They look at the car. Mark's not at the car. He's nowhere to be found. They wait for a little bit. They decide, hey, maybe let's go back to the hotel and see if Mark's there. Maybe he caught a ride with somebody else. Mark's not at the hotel. So they think, well, you know, maybe he hooked up with the contestant from Miss Tanline. Maybe he's staying at her hotel. Maybe he's going to hook up with us tomorrow morning. The next morning, still no sign of Mark. At this point, they're really worried. I mean, they stayed out till 4:30 in the morning anyway. They were already sort of worried. Now they're really worried. At this point, they contact police. They report him missing.
So this is police on South Padre Island?
Yes, this okay. is stateside.
Okay.
So the investigation begins, and the case initially is treated as a typical missing person case. And it's not shocking for an American to show up a few days later after a bad hangover from a tough night of partying in Matamoros and a sketchy recollection of what happened.
I've had many Saturday nights like that myself. So yeah, it doesn't seem like, you know, it's something way out of the ordinary.
In fact, Mark was just one of 60 people who had gone missing in Matamoros during the first few months of 1989. This is a common occurrence.
Yeah.
But thanks to Mark Kilroy's uncle, Ken Kilroy, he worked for the U.S. Customs Service in L.A. He starts moving his connections around, and the search begins really quickly. A police task force is assembled in Brownsville to search for Mark. The Mexican Federale Police Force began cooperating with U.S. authorities almost immediately.
Oh, wow. Just because of his connections to law enforcement? Well, so good for you, Mark.
Yeah. And thank you, Uncle Ken. Both sides begin to suspect foul play almost immediately. They're thinking like a robbery, possible drug deal gone wrong, maybe a potential ransom situation. However, as time goes by, no contact for payment is made. And that's not typical for these ransom situations. Thus, authorities believe Mark is most likely dead. They're starting to think that his body has been dumped somewhere in the Rio Grande area. And this is where U.S. authorities and Mexican state police start to disagree on what's going on the case. So U.S. authorities are not getting a lot of feedback from the Mexican state police side. And in Mexico, there's state police and then there's Federale police. So Federale police are like the FBI, and state police are sort of like state troopers, you know, that level of enforcement.
So the Federales trump everybody else.
Yes.
As far as what their jurisdiction is and what they can command and all of that.
Exactly. And it's not until we get introduced to Commandant Juan Benitez Ayala that things start actually moving along. So Commandant Benitez, he's a badass in this story. Like, he is the honest Federale commandant that comes in who is all about busting up drug lords, and everyone knows he's honest and straightforward.
Which I'm assuming maybe is a little hard to find with somebody, a law enforcement agent based on the border between the United States and Mexico.
Yeah, there's a long history of corruption on the border with Federale police.
I would assume.
And Commandant Benitez, he's like a needle in the haystack. You know, he's a unicorn of rarity when it comes to busting up drug lords. In fact, he doesn't go out to restaurants. He doesn't go out because he's afraid of being poisoned by drug lords. You know, all he wants to do is stay at home and do his police work and do good work. So at this point, Mark's parents head to the area and they start handing out 20,000 flyers, and they're advertising a $50,000 reward for any information of Mark's whereabouts. The Texas governor, the attorney general, and a U.S. senator starts helping the family in this case, and they start, like, drumming up the media. They start getting attention brought into Brownsville specifically to see if Mark is somewhere on the U.S. side. On March 26th, the case was shown on America's Most Wanted, and even national attention didn't unearth any useful leads that authorities could use. They just basically get a bunch of hotline calls that are useless. The more digging, the more questioning, and other missing people cases that are related to Matamoros that the U.S. and Mexican authorities find, they start to phase out some of the other ideas and hypotheses that they had about the case. They start to keep hearing black magic, brujos, even the term El Diablo himself being repeated in statements from witnesses and people from Matamoros. So what they're thinking is, like, this is drug related. This is occult related. And state police is trying to shut this down. They're trying to say that Mark is just, you know, he was looking for drugs. He got hooked up with a bad drug deal. That's it. He probably got shot. End of story. They're clearly hiding something. And we'll see that at the end of the story, a tie in there. Commandant Benitez, he's not buying the state police's explanation, though. He's with U.S. authorities. He thinks something else bigger is going on. He knows about other cases in Mexico City involving the occult, and he's pressing for answers. Meanwhile, Mark's parents, having no luck with their reward flyers out in Brownsville and even some in Matamoros, where they traveled across the border and talked to some people there, handed out some flyers, they're not having any results. They head back to Santa Fe, Texas, and they withdraw their son from his final semester of UT Austin.
Oh, man, that's sad.
Yeah. So April 1st, 1989, Mexican State Police, they're manning a checkpoint as part of the investigation near Santa Elena, which is just outside of Matamoros. And this is part of Benitez's plan, Commandant Benitez. While manning this checkpoint, a truck, out of nowhere, speeds through the checkpoint, avoiding all the police. The officers manning the checkpoint said the driver drove right through the checkpoint as if he thought that he was invisible. Under the direction from Commandant Benitez, follow the vehicle for a distance with an unmarked patrol car. The truck led authorities to a remote ranch in Santa Elena. So the police sit there for like 30 minutes. They don't want to follow the truck into the ranch. They're trying to see what's going on.
So this is a place in Texas?
No. Across this the is border? This is or all
this
in
is
Mexico.
Still in Mexico.
Yeah.
Okay.
Santa Elena, right outside of Matamoros. The Mexican police kind of hang out. They wait for 30 minutes. The truck pulls back out off the ranch road, heads back towards the city. At this point, they make a judgment call, and they go in for a really quick search of the premises. There's nobody there. They discover evidence of drug trafficking at the ranch, and then one of the policemen, he got a glimpse of something that visibly scared him. To anyone who's unfamiliar with occult activities south of the border, this scene would have appeared like an ordinary storage shed with some melted candles, cigar butts, and some empty bottles of liquor on the floor, maybe even some greasy cauldrons sitting outside where some cooking might have been done. But to Mexican police, however, they immediately recognized signs of Santeria and the occult. At this point, police made the decision to go ahead and wait and try and build up a case and get more information via some raids and some interrogations based on Commandant Benitez's recommendation before they actually made any charges, which is interesting because if they would have moved on it really quickly, they might not have caught everyone. They're trying to get everyone in this family cartel that they can involved in this case.
So they're basically just using their powers of deduction. They know that this is bigger than just if they were to, you know, ride in full throttle on this place. They weren't going to find anybody. They weren't going to really make connections. There's nobody there. So they're just going to stand off and wait and see what they can find and the connections they can make to the people who are coming to this place and being involved in these occult / drug activities.
Exactly. Because Benitez knows that this runs deeper than just a few people.
He knows that there's this integration of the occult and the drug cartel.
Exactly.
Okay.
So on April 9th, almost a week later, the Mexican authorities arrive at the Santa Elena Ranch and they arrest cartel leader Eliar Hernandez, his nephew Serafin, who was the driver of the truck that ran through the checkpoint, along with other cult members, including David Valdez and Sergio Salinas. They also arrest Santa Elena Ranch caretaker Domingo Bustamante. The first to confess was caretaker Bustamante. He identified Mark and remembered seeing him the night that he went missing. So in an interrogation room of the Matamoros jail, the other four suspects quickly confess and they admit to kidnapping Mark and to witnessing his ritual sacrifice, which even the federales and the U.S. authorities are like, wow, that was fast. So once this story hits the wires and these arrests are made, some of the occult details start to emerge. U.S. and international media, they start swarming into the Brownsville and Matamoros area. They're trying to cover the story. Teams of journalists are dispatched immediately and planes are chartered. It's also, again, like you said earlier, it's important to remember this is the Satanic Panic period. And so these media outlets, they're trying to grab as much as they can for the evening news. So this case not only fed perfectly into the ongoing narrative of the Satanic Panic, but it would fuel further unrest in the U.S. and internationally regarding the dangers of Satanic cults. Field reporters from Geraldo Rivera and Oprah Winfrey were stationed in Matamoros, Texas.
Yeah, so everybody in the national media is just up in arms about this case. And for good reason, I would think it's feeding everybody's fears about what's going on with the Satanic Panic, what's going on with our children at the border interacting with, you know, people who are not Americans and getting hurt because of it. So it's every like modern American suburban housewife or house husband's fears about their children getting involved in this kind of ridiculous situation. Yeah, but unfortunately, in this case, it's actually true.
Yeah, it's their worst nightmare. Yeah, I mean, even countries like Japan and Germany sent major reporting crews over to cover the case.
Huh.
Yeah. And these are completely non-English, non-Spanish speaking journalist groups, which, by the way, Comandante Benitez, He's very open with the media. One might say that he's a little too open. When the media inquired how the Mexican Federale police got the confession so quickly, for instance, one of the agents bragged that they used mineral water shot up their noses when they didn't want to talk.
I thought you were going to say shot up their butts. So, I mean, if I had a choice, I would rather it shot up my nose.
But you remember the Guantanamo Bay waterboarding situation, though. Yeah, no,
that's pretty terrible.
Yeah.
Shouldn't do that to make anybody talk. Because as we know, you're just going to get a lot of people lying because they want you to stop shooting water up their nose.
Yeah, a lot of false confessions
exactly.
To stop drowning me. So Serafin Hernandez, the nephew of Elio, the one driving the truck, he tells authorities, with the help of three others, he kidnapped Mark Kilroy that Monday night in Matamoros. He also tells them that Alfonso Constanzo El Patrino wanted him to find a young white man studying medicine to use in a ritual. He also admits that he was the one to bury Mark. And so at this point, authorities are thinking, okay, we can find Mark's remains because we have the guy who can lead us to where his remains are. So on April 11th, the authorities return to the Santa Elena Ranch with four of the suspects. They used Serafin to lead them to the gravesite. But beforehand, Commandant Benitez insists that a curandero, or a medicine man, come along to cleanse away any remaining black magic. And after his work was done, Serafin led the investigators to a piece of wire coming out of the ground. Serafin explained, that under orders from El Patrino, as we know, Adolfo Constanzo, he had cut open Mark's back and attached a wire to his backbones before burying his body. So the plan was, after Mark's body would have decomposed for some time, El Patrino would have returned and been able to pull the vertebrae that this wire was tied to out of the earth and be able to take them and make them into a necklace or some sort of talisman.
Question. So we haven't gotten into this in this podcast, but one of my specialties is osteology, or the study of bones, both human and animal. And so this is something that you talked with me before, and I have a question. So what they did was they took a wire and they threaded it through the vertebral foramen, or essentially, okay, so you have vertebrae.
Yep.
That are going all through your spine. The vertebrae are kind of circular bits of bone. They have a big hole through the center of them. And that hole is where your spinal cord goes through. So you have a full layer of protection all around, 360 degrees all around your spinal cord, going all the way down your back. So what they did is they threaded this wire through that central foramen all the way down the spinal cord, and then looped it up, and then buried his body to where they would just pull that wire and pull up the vertebral column.
Again, you're a bloodhound when it comes to suspecting what's happened. There's no photo evidence of this, but we know from looking at other Payo-Mayombe ritualistic killings that this is something that was done in a practice to make this ritualistic necklace. And in fact, you're right that the wire was threaded down through the spinal column, wrapped around itself, because that is the truth. That is what happened.
So the idea is to be honest, it's hard for me to imagine that you can thread a wire through that central foramen all the way down the spine with a fresh body.
Yeah.
Because like I said, it's full of the spinal column. So
sure.
I mean, I don't know. I've never tried it myself.
Well, basically.
But I mean, what it looks like based on this picture you've given me of a similar example, it looks like what it is. It's almost like wire that you would see in a clothes hanger.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a fairly thin wire, but very sturdy.
Yeah.
So I guess you could really shove it in there.
So what they did was is they fed it down in a hollow metal tube and just rammed it through the spinal column.
Hmm.
And they had his whole back cut open.
Wow.
So where they could find it coming out of the bottom end and then pull it through and tie it off. And then bury him.
It's really weird because, I mean, you're talking about this being sort of an occultist necklace. This is exactly what you would see if you were studying anatomy and physiology or osteology. This is exactly the setup for a spinal column that you would see of a specimen, where you would have a wire or fishing line, something like that, that would be threaded through that vertebral foramen all the way up through the spinal column. And it would be kind of tied off in this similar way, that way that you can actually look at the vertebral column of one individual and see how the bones articulate and everything like that. So it's very much almost like an anatomical study of the vertebral column, but this was the way that they would create their occultist jewelry,
I guess, exactly.
At the same time. So it's very weird from like a analytical / academic standpoint. It's incredibly interesting. But at the same time, it's horrific.
It's super horrific and all sorts of freaky deaky.
Yeah.
And again, this is one of the details that makes you think that this is not real, that there's something wrong with
absolutely.
This case.
I mean, it sounds fake. And I think this is the first thing that you told me about this case. And I was like, no,
that sounds wrong.
That just doesn't make any sense to me. But the way that you're describing it, as if they did this in preparation, then they buried the body and waited for the body to decompose, and then they were going to pull out the spinal column. I mean, I guess that would work. That's something.
Apparently, this has traditional history behind it. And
wow.
This is something that was done with even bones that were grave robbed. So, like, people would sneak in after a fresh body was buried and do this, let the body decompose so that they could pull the vertebrae out and make a talisman with it.
I mean, I guess that's a lot easier than trying to macerate a body and collect all the vertebrae that way. I mean,
yeah,
I guess.
Well, I mean, you know, what was their access to hydrogen peroxide back then? And, you know, like, the science of maceration. So once Mark's body, it's uncovered and unearthed, the Comandante, he notices that Mark's legs have been cut off. And he asks Serafin about this, and Serafin admits that it just made him easier to bury, and that they used his limbs in other rituals. And the whole time, Serafin is just talking about Mark's death and his ritualistic burial as if he's discussing the weather. And he's very clearly indoctrinated into this cult to believe it 100%. And he keeps thinking that he's not in trouble and that El Padrino's just going to swoop in at any moment and rescue everybody and walk out because he's invincible. He's protected. And we're going to get into more of that, of the protection aspect. So by mid-afternoon, there were 12 bodies that Serafin had led the Federales to find in this corral next to the shed. They're all laid out in a row, including Mark's. And it's at this point that the media has, they've made it down to the area. They've shown up. They've figured out where the ranch is. They're coming into the perimeter of the scene. And the Comandante, he welcomes them into the scene.
And this is both American and Mexican media?
Yes, it's international.
Okay.
And you know,
the Japanese and all
everybody.
The other places.
Yeah, okay. Everybody. At this point, the media is standing in the scene itself. They're kind of doing their own searching and questioning of the suspects that have been brought back to the ranch. They're finding clues that they're pointing out to the Federales while taking pictures. It's a madhouse as far as crime scene investigation goes. U.S. authorities are not happy about it, but again, it's a Mexican operation. So yeah, it's something like where the U.S. authorities are basically operating under Mexican authority, and they really don't have any grounds to cause a lot of questions about what's going on. Meanwhile, the media is just stomping around the ranch, poking in mounds of dirt, seeing if there's a burial here, looking in haystacks, you know, trying to find some little photo, video, soundbite that they can use on the evening news. By the end of the day, the suspects have unearthed 15 mutilated bodies. So at this point, all four of the suspects have been digging. And the Federales are forcing them to dig up the victims, which is weird in itself. All 15 mutilated bodies are males, and they've all had some or all of their organs, what they can tell, removed. Specifically the brain, the chest cavity, and their testicles.
Chest cavity, what do you mean by chest cavity? Like the heart?
The heart, the lungs, the liver, intestines.
Okay, so yeah. Like just basically all of their internal organs.
Yeah, all like their internal organs, their brain, and their testicles are missing.
Okay. That's really interesting, just as a side note, because this is a drug cartel. You would want, like, female organs or females. You would want, like, very masculine men, and you would want the masculine organs, especially, like, the testicles and the brain.
Yeah, it's machismo. You know? Like, you want victims that are powerful, and you want to use their power to build up your operation and to fuel your rituals on.
Mm-hmm.
So here it's good to point out that three of the bodies are never identified, but a dozen of them are. So the other 12 victims are actually identified. Besides the bodies at the Santa Elena Ranch, the Mexican Federale Police sees 110 kilos, which is 243 pounds, of marijuana. They find 100 grams of cocaine, 12 firearms, including machine guns, and they also discover 11 vehicles equipped with telephones, which for the time was a very elaborate expense.
Hmm. All of that for, like, marijuana and a little bit of coke?
Well, it's not a big haul as far as drug busts go, but who's to say what was there at the ranch, you know, at the time of the bust?
So it almost seems like this was just a little side thing. They're like, this wasn't a major hub or a major headquarters of this operation. Like, this was just a side thing. Maybe I'm getting ahead of you here, but do they have reason to believe that there are bigger places with even more bodies that this whole drug ring operated in?
Yes.
Oh, yikes. We have 15 bodies in Santa Elena alone.
Yes.
A very small little offshoot, it sounds like, of this drug ring. That is terrifying.
Yes. Now let's get into the other items that were found in specifically in the shed which, remember, the caretaker talked about Mark was brought to the shed, and that was the last he saw him. So near the corrals, in the shed, they find a satanic altar. This includes an iron pot, which investigators discover the remains of a human brain, a goat's head, chicken feet, a turtle, several herbs, a horseshoe, and coins, as well as a mixture of different animals' blood. This also has those particular sticks I was talking about earlier that are those ritualistic percussion sticks that are used on drums. It's just full of those sticks. And then deep down in the center are all these other remains. So I have a picture of a setup once the Federales pulled all of the items from the altar out to the edge of the shed. They kind of set it up so the media could have their photo op with all these things.
All right, so this is just a big rusty-looking pot with just wooden sticks stuck into an amorphous goo that looks like it, but like you said, this is a mixture of human and animal organs.
Yeah. Ugh. And you see other little pots that were initially set up as satellite offerings at this altar. So you'll see down below, there's a closer view of one of the larger pots that shows some of the chicken bones and a chunk of the human brain in the cauldron.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the photo below that, you'll see the actual altar before the Federales move the items with all the liquor and a huge box of cigars that's sitting there where they were burning cigars. There's some already burned cigars next to it.
Okay, I have a question. So I see a bunch of liquor or beer bottles. I see the box of cigars. I see what looks like a snifter of wine or mm-hmm. brandy or something.
A big one.
What's this little tiny figurine? It looks like a man sitting in a chair.
So I was curious about that too.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, this is one of those things that depends on what particular region you're from, who this figure is. But this is supposed to be Satanás. Like, this is supposed to be the satanic cult's figurehead, their motto, their logo that's in this throne receiving these offerings.
This is supposed to be Satan.
Pretty much.
Well, he's not very imposing. I have to say that yeah. much. It's just like a tiny little doll sitting in a chair. I thought you were going to say it's like one of the drug cartel leaders. I didn't know if you were going to say that was actually supposed to be Satan himself.
From everything I've
not
looked
very
at,
imposing, yeah. Satan.
But again, you notice that he has a dark complexion, much like a Haitian doll figurine that would be on one of their sacrificial altars. Huh. So that goes back to Adolfo's Haitian background. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the artifacts and the altar?
I mean, I'm absolutely fascinated by all of this. It's weird because, you know, as you know about me, I'm a huge fan of osteology. So anything having to do with remains or bones is something that's sort of academically very interesting to me. But at the same time, knowing that these were people who they kidnapped, Mark being only one of several that they kidnapped and killed and used in these rituals is so disturbing. I mean, I don't know. I don't even really have words to describe how just upsetting that is. To know that there are occultists out there who are willing to kill people for whatever their ends are, especially if their ends are something as stupid as your drug ring.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't really have good words to describe how just such a waste of life that is.
It is. And, you know, the disturbing facts are more than that because we haven't even talked about how Mark died.
Mm.
And that comes out in Commandant Benitez's report. And, you know, this is an international case. It's mostly been held closed because they're doing ongoing work to find more of this cult's organization, more of their victims, and trying to tie in more cases as they go along. So we're only getting bits and pieces from the federal Mexican police.
So I have a question about the night that he was kidnapped. You said that his friends last saw him as he was talking to Miss Tanlines. Do we have any reason to believe that Miss Tanlines was a distraction, that she was kind of in on it, and they were able to drive by and grab him?
No, I mean, not at all. She was questioned and cleared pretty early in the case.
Well, I just have a question because you said that they were specifically looking for a medical student.
Yes, correct.
An American medical student. So do we know how they figured out that that was him?
So in one of Serafin's confessions, he tells Federales that his other accomplices in the abduction, he has them working in the town looking for someone who is an American medical student. And as Mark is in the club talking to some of his female friends, he's separated from his other male friends there for a time. We can ascertain that he might have been doing a little bragging, talking about his schooling, may have dropped the fact that, hey, he's a pre-med student.
Okay.
That's about all we know. All right, so we're ready to get into the Commandant's report.
Mm-hmm.
So the disturbing facts of how Mark's last moments went down are described in Commandant Benitez's report. Quote, first, the high priest offered up the sacrifice, cutting the victim's throat, or in this case, Mark, taking off the top of his head with a machete. The victims were usually killed first, then mutilated. They would take out the brains, the heart, the lungs, and the testicles, which would be boiled in an iron kettle. Everything else, organ-wise, would be removed from the chest cavity and thrown out. The resulting brew from the cauldron would be passed around among members of the cult so that they could drink and be sanctified. After that, laymen of the cult buried the remains in and around the corral behind the shed, typically led by one of the higher-ranking members of the cult. The ultimate piety and conceit of this cult was the abiding belief that this act of unholy communion would make its members invincible. And that's right out of Benitez's report of the overall killings. So Mark's body was officially identified after his dental records were matched to those that were supplied to Brownsville by his family. And on April 12th, the detainees were taken out to the headquarters of the Mexican Federale Police in Matamoros for an informal press conference. More than 250 international journalists arrive at the scene to take pictures and to ask questions of the suspects. The four suspects were brought out onto the balcony over the street and were allowed to answer questions into microphones that are on long poles that the reporters below on the street would push up to them. Elio came forward, answered questions, and he stated that he was an ordained executioner under Costanzo and that Kilroy was murdered by Costanzo himself. As the cameras zoom in on the suspects, Elio showed off his membership scars on his shoulder, back, arms, and chest. And these were arrow-like cuts made by a hot blade via El Patrino or Costanzo and gave him the authority to perform human sacrifice. And I actually have a picture of Elio's tattoo or ritual scarring.
This weird, like, rune-looking thing?
Yeah, it's like arrows and crossing straight lines with little arrow points.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very weird, but it's been matched to other occult symbols associated with Santeria and Payomeyombe cases. The next day in Matamoros, law enforcement, they raid Aldrete's house. They're trying to find Costanzo and Aldrete. So in Aldrete's house, they discover an altar and several religious symbols. They also state that her entire house's interior is covered in blood. And yeah, exactly. Sarah, however, appeared to have fled the city with Costanzo, and they're getting other reports that he's been seen south of town in his brand new Mercedes-Benz. So Mexico City police, they're following this case. They're paying close attention specifically because they've noticed that these Matamoros killings are very similar to some murders that have been carried out in Mexico City between 1987 and 1989. They begin wondering if Costanzo and his cults have been the killers all along and that they've moved north to Matamoros. Word begins to spread that Costanzo has returned to Mexico City and that he's probably hiding in one of the boroughs that he's familiar with in Mexico City. So on May 6, 1989, the police surround what they suspect is one of Costanzo's safe houses associated with the cult. They're starting to move in to do some surveillance, see what's going on, and there's actually like an incident out in the street that the police have to take care of. Adolfo Costanzo actually sees what's going out on the street, and he thinks the jig is up. He thinks that they're onto him, and he thinks that he's already surrounded. And so he immediately busts open a window and starts shooting a machine gun out at the street where the police are. He then starts tossing money out the window.
It's a bit of a overreaction.
Yeah, and he...
Wait, why is he tossing money out the window? Is he trying to, like, actively bribe them while shooting at them? Or, I mean, what's going on?
No, he also starts burning the rest of his money on the stove. There's some people who think this is, like, ritualistic.
Oh, okay.
You know, and like, he's starting to make his final sacrifice of all of his work and his power. And he's trying to take that with him to hell.
Are you trying to do, like, a suicide by cop situation, or...?
Oh, no. You'll see.
Oh, okay.
So, eventually, seeing no other way out, he orders one of his closest cult members and oftentimes lover, Alvaro de Leon Valdez, nicknamed El Dube, to ritualistically kill him and one of his lovers, Quintana Rodriguez, before he could be captured by Mexican authorities. At first, El Dube, he doesn't want to do this, you know, and he starts to hesitate, but Costanzo slaps him in the face and he reminds him, you're going to suffer in hell if you don't go through with this and do my commands.
Aren't they a satanic cult?
Well, yeah, but...
Isn't that kind of like their end game anyway?
I think he's basically saying, once you get down there, I'm going to punish you if you don't do this.
Oh, okay. Yeah. As opposed to like a lovely time in hell that they were all planning on.
Yeah, fun time. Fun party time.
Okay.
And so De Leon, he empties his machine gun and kills Adolfo Costanzo and his girlfriend, Quintana Rodriguez, in a closet in the bedroom.
Was she okay with this?
There's
against her will.
That's not in the reports.
Okay.
So, I mean, Sarah Aldrete is there, and De Leon El Dube is there, and they say that she did it willingly, but we don't really have a lot to go off of.
Okay.
So, after the gunshots, everything quiets down in the apartment. Mexican police, they raid in. They apprehend everybody. They capture De Leon, Sarah Aldrete, along with five other remaining cult members. So Federale investigators in Mexico believe Adolfo Costanzo himself could be responsible for over 30 satanic cult-related killings just in Mexico. The number has been updated in recent years, so they think that this could be at least 40-plus people.
And how old was he? Because he was 26 when he first met Elio.
Yeah, this is only like a couple years later, so yeah.
So... an average of one death at least per year he was alive.
So he's in Mexico from 1984, and this happens in 1989, his death. So that's 5 years. He possibly could have killed upwards of 40, 50 people in those 5 years.
Wow. And so is this just working with Elio and his group, or is this other... I mean, what other things was he involved in?
Well, like we talked about earlier, he had started in Mexico City. And he had worked with other drug lords and made a name for himself there doing similar activities and building his cult. And there were previous murders in Mexico City that were outstanding for occult-related activities before he went to Matamoros.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. It's a busy guy.
So on a quiet Sunday afternoon when no one was looking, the Federales slipped into the ranch at Santa Elena, and they brought a curandero with them, a medicine man. And he goes inside the shed, he mumbles some incantations, he sprinkles some salt on the floor, he makes the sign of the cross, and then the Federales slosh gasoline all over the shed and burn it to the ground. So, thus cleansing the area of these horrible, horrible murders.
Wow. And remind me again, how many bodies were found at this ranch?
16. And three of them were never identified. They later go on to find 25 total bodies in the Matamoros area outside of the ranch.
Were these all Americans that they had kidnapped, or were these also...
Oh, no. Most of them, a lot of them were other, like, rival drug dealers.
Oh, and, okay. Well, at least that makes sense.
Yeah. And so, like, some of the people that they would abduct, like, if they wanted to get strength, they would abduct a very strong person. And they would cut their muscles off and put them in the cauldron for the ritual. If they wanted to get youth, they would find a little boy. And they would kill a child.
And so Mark was targeted specifically, what, for his brains?
Yes.
I mean, I guess literally, but because...
Yeah, so Costanzo, he had made it known that he wanted a medical student, and he wanted someone smart that had knowledge of medicine. And okay. Also, if Sarah Aldrete was there, as a lot of people suspect that she was involved, she still claims that she wasn't involved, and that she was a captive and forced to participate in the occult, But there's a lot of evidence that shows that she was actively participating, if not kind of the honeypot scenario of luring some of the victims. So you want to get to some of the convictions?
Absolutely. Let's convict these fuckers.
On May 3rd, 1994, Aldrete was sentenced to 62 years in prison. Cult members Elio and Serafine Jr., Martinez Salinas, and Serna Valdez received 67 years each. On June 2nd, 1989, Salvador Vidal Garcia Alacron, a police chief in the Federal Judicial Police, who was stationed in Matamoros, so this is a federale, he was indicted for drug trafficking and also linked to Costanzo by Sara Aldrete. And so he's involved in the initial cover-up with the state police of what was going on with Mark's disappearance. He's found guilty.
Sara Aldrete is on one hand saying that she didn't have anything to do with this and she knows nothing, but is also pointing her fingers at these people who are helping them cover up.
Yeah.
You can't have it both ways, Sara Aldrete.
Yeah, and there's also reports that like the state police also were helping the occult by giving them uniforms and badges to basically do whatever they wanted in Matamoros and get carte blanche throughout the city.
Oh, wow. So they're just basically being paid off, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and in one of Serafine's stories, he's actually has Mark in the Suburban during the abduction and other police stop him. And they're having a discussion and they're telling them who they are. And they're just about to let them go when Mark gets out of the SUV and runs towards the main drag where everyone's partying. One of Serafine's gang members, he yells freeze and Mark thinks it's the police and that he's safe. They just get him, put the handcuffs on him, duct tape over his head, put him back in the Suburban. And take him to the ranch.
Is that true?
It's one of Serafine's many different stories that he gave police, but a lot of people think it could be true.
That's really messed up if that's true.
So yeah, besides, you know, the cult members that died, this federale policeman, Elio, Serafine, all the other five cult members that were caught in Mexico, the two from the ranch in Santa Elena, they're all still in prison.
Along with Sara Aldrete.
Yes.
Is Elio ever going to be getting out?
Well, he got 62 years, and he was in his early to mid-20s when all this went down, so He'll be in his 80s.
Well, he seems like a real douche.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. He was a full-on believer. And, you know, that's the one of the interesting parts about this whole series of murders and this cult and their activities is that the federales and the U.S. authorities, they believed that this Payo Mayombe cult, their followers were so indoctrinated and that they believed literally that they were invincible, invisible, that they had satanic powers, that these rituals were actually giving them abilities to do their drug dealings and to practice their religion. And like we said, even Adolfo Costanzo, he eats his own religion that he's been making up on the fly. But at the very end, when he does a final sacrifice ritual and does a ritualistic killing of him and his girlfriend in his apartment. So it's very extreme.
I mean, I guess what we're basically saying is this sounds like any other religion or any other cult where it's all confirmation bias and you can be led to believe anything absolutely just on faith if you're being told it enough and if the things that you are doing seem to be having a positive effect. And they got away with this for so long that in of itself was a bit of confirmation bias.
Yeah.
Especially if they were having these interactions with the police force who were doing nothing. I mean, it really seems like they, you know, just the reality of it was we are protected by Satan or whoever because nobody did anything.
Exactly. Yeah, it's an echo chamber of satanic extremism that just fuels itself, you know?
Well, I hope that they at least are rotting in jail and are, you know, starting to think, oh, maybe that wasn't the right thing for us to do. Maybe Satan had nothing to do with this.
Yeah. And then, you know, this case, like we talked about, it would do a lot to fuel the satanic panic in the media. And this was like a clear example of the extremisms of the occult. And what could happen to a good Catholic boy who is just hanging out at the border? You know, interesting about other Payo Mayombe cases around the country, there would be more occult murders in Florida and as well in as New Jersey and New York, where they would use this case to help break up Payo Mayombe cults in drug-related activities later on. All right, so let's get back to Mark. This is his final moment. So his parents were actually notified on April 13th that his body had been found. And it actually happened during a religious ceremony that was intended to revive hope for finding Mark's safe return, which is sad.
Yeah.
So they kind of had an impromptu, like, prayer and, you know, kind of a grieving moment there. And then, you know, later on, thousands of people would go on to attend Mark's memorial service held in Brownsville, Texas. And almost everyone wore yellow ribbons that said, "Miss you, Mark." And as far as the other victims that were found at the ranch, you know, some of the villagers near Matamoros and the farmers there that were related to the victims, they had some interesting things to say about this case. Because, of course, this case only got covered because, again, it's a white American, you know. You would think that that would cause, like, people to be upset and to feel that they're not worthy of being covered. But, interestingly enough, some of those family members, one of them said to one of the detectives, "If it weren't for the Kilroy boy, none of the other men, including my son, would have ever found justice."
I mean, yeah, that's true, but then again, it sucks that it has to be the white American boy that gets
definitely.
Justice for everyone else.
It does suck, but, you know, if it hadn't been for their ramping up and starting to take a white tourist during spring break...
Oh, they could be still doing this.
Yeah, exactly. So there's some other fun facts about this case that are kind of interesting. So Henry Lee Lucas is associated with this case.
Oh, how so?
A map drawn in 1987 by serial killer Henry Lee Lucas had predicted the inexplicable accuracy that bodies of victims of satanic rituals would be found in this general area. And it's, like, almost exactly where the ranch is.
What? How would he know that?
I don't know. This is just a weird fact that Henry Lee Lucas
Lucas. He said so much, though. A few of the lies that he told, I'm sure, were bound to be true. Come on.
Yeah.
He was such a liar.
Yeah.
By the end of it, what was he claiming? Like 3,000 murders? Get over yourself, Henry.
I thought it was a fun fact.
No, that's definitely a fun fact, but I don't believe he had anything to do with this group.
Yeah. There's also a Texas death metal band called Gruesome Fate. And they perform a song called Padrino de la Matamoros, obviously a death metal song about these ritual killings.
Have you listened to it?
No, but we should.
We should after this.
It's their lead track on their 2016 release. So this was only 2 years ago. And then there's another
Texas death metal band. Where are they from?
I think they're from Brownsville, the Brownsville area.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then there's another band called Brujeria. And they're a death metal band whose lyrics focus on Satanism, anti-Christianity, sex, drug smuggling, and they put a picture of a severed head on their album Matando Hieros. We'll go with that.
Okay.
And the head is believed to be a victim of Adolfo Costanzo's cult. Like a picture that they
cool,
got a hold
guys.
Of. Yeah, that's not cool.
Cool
at all. But that's all I have on this case. So I hope you enjoyed satanic cults on the Texas border.
I did. I mean, that's really fascinating. And I don't know if I've ever really heard about this case.
Hey, thank you, Comandante Benitez. Like, that dude, even though he was 5 foot tall, he was a total badass.
Yeah. Well, besides the torture.
Yeah, that's true. Don't waterboard people. But do break up satanic murdering drug cults.
Absolutely. Yeah. Every chance you get.
And ferret out corruption in Mexico.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's just really sad that this group was responsible for so many deaths, and we'll probably never know how many. I mean, it's good that they
probably
got their comeuppance. But I hope they never get out of prison.
Yeah. Also, they don't have the death penalty in Mexico. And there was a lot of work that was trying to pull them to get extradited to Texas so that they could get
the
death penalty.
Oh, yeah. We would have killed them.
Yeah.
For sure.
But unfortunately, they got tried by Mexican legal system.
Well, most countries, if that's the case, they won't extradite prisoners to America for that exact reason if they don't have the death penalty and they know that we do and that they could be possibly up for it. So that's not that surprising. But yeah, we probably would have killed them. So I guess there's that. Okay, well, that was a pretty messed up story about satanic death cults. So would you like a nice palate cleanser? Would you like some good news?
Yes.
I've got a very sweet little story that was sent to us by our friend and listener, Monk. So thank you, Monk, for sending this story to us because it's very perfect for our podcast. And this is the story about Oscar the Dr. Pepper drinking donkey.
Oh, a burro.
A burro. And so does everybody know what Dr. Pepper is? I mean, people from other countries.
It's a southern brown cola drink that's sweet, if you don't know what it is.
Yeah, and it was made here in Dublin, Texas,
mm-hmm.
is when it was by first manufactured. And it's really popular, at least in Texas. I don't know if it's across the South it's popular, but yeah. It's very popular here in Texas. I'm not a huge Dr. Pepper fan.
It's all right.
But it's very big here. And so...
you should try it once.
So we have this guy. He owns a farm in Paradise, Texas, which I believe is close to Springtown.
Mm-hmm.
Which the only reason why I know that is because Springtown is close to Weatherford.
Yep. I have family in Springtown. It's yeah, north exactly. of the Metroplex. Yep.
And this guy, Herschel Pearson is his name. He and his wife raised up this little donkey. They named him Oscar. They raised him from a foal. And he was actually kept to keep the wild hogs away from the ranch. Which oh, I didn't yeah. know donkeys did. Huh. Do they do that? Do I they think chase
so.
Them off?
Yeah, I think so. I think they also will chase off coyotes too.
Oh, okay. Well, that was kind of Oscar's little job around the ranch. And he loved Dr. Pepper. And the reason, the way they found out about this is one day when Oscar was like a little donkey, he knocked over Herschel's can of Dr. Pepper that he was drinking and started lapping it off the ground. And so Herschel thought this was really funny. And so he would give Oscar some a little bit of Dr. Pepper every now and again, and it became like this way that they kind of bonded, where they'd Aww. All they both share a Dr. Pepper together, not unlike I'm sure the way that our dogs knock over our beers yeah. because they love beer. We true. Our dogs are Lushes, and so are we.
Yeah, well, you know, Texas is famous for a lot of drinking animals. There's that beer drinking goat that's the mayor of Terlingua, Texas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Beer and Dr. Pepper. It's so Texas, isn't it?
Yeah.
They raised their little guy, Oscar. And then a couple years ago, Oscar just completely goes missing.
What?
He goes missing. Nobody can find him. They do like this huge search all around their property. He is just completely gone. They have no idea what happened to him. And so eventually, I mean, obviously they were really sad, but they had to kind of move on with their life thinking maybe Oscar, maybe somebody stole him, maybe he ran off somewhere.
Well, that sucks.
Yeah.
I thought you said this was good news.
Well, what we've noticed in these good news stories is it always starts down low, but then it ends up turning itself around.
Yeah.
So the good part of this good news is a couple weeks ago, Oscar appeared back on the ranch.
What?
They have no idea how he got back. He was in perfectly good condition. He just needed his hooves to be trimmed a little. But other than that, he was doing fine. And at first, when they saw him, they didn't know if it was Oscar or not. I mean, donkeys don't really look that different from one another. And they hadn't seen him for a couple years. And the way that they found out that it was, in fact, Oscar was Herschel brought out a can of Dr. Pepper, opened the tab, and Oscar came running over to get some.
Oh, dang.
And so they had this, they had this very sweet reunion. And they have no idea why. They don't know if somebody stole him and then ended up bringing him back for some reason. They have no idea, but they're just really happy to be reunited.
Please tell me there's a video of this Dr. Pepper drinking donkey.
There is a fantastic video that I will post on our social media, not only because Oscar is really adorable and you can see the guy feeding him the Dr. Pepper, but because Herschel is like the most Texas country dude. He has the strongest Texas accent and it's kind of amazing.
That's awesome.
When they asked Herschel why they thought Oscar came back to him, and he, you know what his response was?
What?
Oh, I don't know. He probably missed the Dr. Pepper.
No. It's not for love or anything. It's just the Dr.
He
Pepper.
He just needed that Dr. Pepper. And that is your good news. Herschel right. and Oscar reunited.
Well, that's pretty good. I like that. I like donkeys. So that's a good story for me.
Weird thing to say. I like donkeys.
I like donkeys and Dr. Pepper. So it's good for me. All right, here we go. Let's wrap this baby up. Let's move into some iTunes reviews.
Da, 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 da.
So if you don't know, if you go to our page on iTunes and leave us a 5-star review, tell us what you think about the show. We will read your comments on the show and give you a shout out. We appreciate it. It helps us out. It helps us disseminate the podcast out to more people.
It does help us out a lot. And it doesn't even have to be related to the show. If you want to say something goofy and have us read it on the air, we will do it.
Yeah, I would
if
like.
If it gets you to leave us a 5-star review, I don't care.
Old Western jokes, like whatever you want to put on there.
Leave us a weird joke. I would love it.
Okay, so the first one we have is TC52369. They said, love. That's the title of the review. That'd be weird if it was the first thing they just said. It's like, love! But they say, this crime podcast is great and entertaining. Can't wait for more. Thank you, TC.
Thank you, and a true statement.
Mm-hmm.
If ever I've heard one, that was a true statement.
Next up is It's Me, Missy. I believe Missy just followed us somewhere else, too. I saw her popping up.
Hey, Missy, what's up? What's up, girl?
She says, thumbs up. 5 stars. Pretty awesome so far. My new secret obsession. Keep it up.
Oh,
thank you, Missy. We appreciate that. I almost forgot. We also have Jill76513. She says, all crime, no cattle. 5 stars. Enjoying hearing about Texas true crimes. Keep up the good work.
Awesome.
Thank you, guys. You guys rock.
Thank you very much.
We love our true crime posse that follows us around helping bust up banditos, even on social media.
And we have one more review, and it also comes with a bit of an announcement. So we have made a Facebook page on Facebook. I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. But if you search for us on Facebook, you can find us, and we'll be posting a lot of the same stuff that we post on Twitter and on Instagram. So if you don't have Twitter or you're not on Instagram, you can follow us there on Facebook, and hopefully you'll be able to see us in our feeds. You can see all of our bonus content and all of our behind-the-scenes information, as well as additional links that pertain to the episode of the day. And we have our first review from that page.
Awesome.
And the review is from Allison, and she says, awesome podcast, keep up the great job, love the concept and the banter.
Oh, thank you, Allison.
So thank you, Allison. Thank you for our very first Facebook review. And again, if you would like to get a shout out on the show, just please leave us a 5-star iTunes review, or you can go to our new Facebook page and leave us a 5-star review there, and we will read it on the air.
And we do have a promo this week, correct? That we're playing after the show?
We do. This is another really awesome podcast. This is from the UK. We're very international. So far, we've had a Canadian podcast and an Australian podcast. This one is coming from the UK. The guy who writes it, produces it, narrates it, his name is Mike, and he does a really excellent job. He has this beautiful, soothing English accent that's really fantastic, and the podcast is told in this storytelling kind of narrative that has all to do with crime and murder in London, and it's apparently also connected with this walk that you could do where if you're in London, you can listen to a podcast about murders in this particular area, and you can just go and do this tour, which I want him to expand and do this everywhere because it would be so amazing. Yeah. Come to Fort Worth, Mike.
Yeah, I love
this. Come to Dallas.
I love this concept. I make maps for a living, and he uses technology that I use at work.
And anything to get me off my ass and also gives me murder is something that I need in my life.
Yeah. Did you say what it's called, though? I think you didn't.
It's called Murder Mile.
Yeah.
I think I did.
Yeah. So what he did is he took like a radius of 1 mile around his apartment or like where he lives in that area. And he looked up all the murders from that area. And he's like covering each one as he goes along and adding it to the walking map. So it's a really cool idea.
Yeah, it's very cool. So definitely check out that podcast. And here is Mike. Thank you guys for listening.
Yeah. And as always, crime is bigger in Texas, y'all.
Bye.
Adios.
Welcome to the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast. My name is Michael, and each week I shall take you on a guided walk of hundreds of untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within 1 square mile. Proving that, if you dig deep enough, you'll find that on every street, in every city, there's a killer on every corner, death on every doorstep, and homicide in every home. Murder Mile is investigated using original police files and eyewitness testimony, with authentic sounds recorded at the murder location itself, and is accompanied by photos, videos, and maps to make you feel like you're actually there. A new episode of the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast is released every Thursday on almost every podcast platform. Thank you. Enjoy your day.